Welcome to Celebrating Whole Health, a program focusing on remembering, reinvigorating, and creating a renaissance of relationship-centered whole person healthcare. Each week, we profile the work of a nurse dedicated to providing compassionate, patient-centered care. I'm your host, Georgiana Donadio, director of the New England School of Whole Health Education in Boston.
Today, my guest is Nurse Elaine Hanglin. Elaine is a clinical nurse specialist who is certified in cardiac risk reduction. She is the current director of the Wellness and Integrative Healthcare Services at Portsmouth Regional Hospital in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Elaine was a lieutenant in the United States Air Force during the Vietnam conflict, and from 1968 to 1969, she served as a support nurse at a casualty staging hospital in Da Nang. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be on your show, Georgiana.
Well, I am so pleased, Elaine, to have you on, and I just want to share this with you and the audience. So often when we prepare to interview someone, we think we're going to be talking about a particular genre of medicine, and what happens in the evolution of that pre-interview interview is we come across an amazing story, and we've heard a few of those in the last month here at Nurse Daily. Your story, Elaine, is another one of those gems that we find planted in the middle of a life that is a very compelling and very moving story. And I want to start, however, at what you're presently doing now and the wonderful, wonderful work that you're doing up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at the hospital. And would like to start, as we always do, tell us about your background in nursing and how you began. I know you have a Master's of Science in Nursing from the University of New Hampshire, and you are certified as a cardiac risk reduction specialist. So tell us about your nursing background and how you evolved into being a cardiac specialist.
Well, I graduated from Seton Hall University, so I started out with a BSN, and that was my basic preparation. I worked in med-surg for a number of years and probably spent a lot of my career in critical care, doing critical care nursing, both in the military and as a civilian. I enjoyed doing critical care. It was, for me, certainly exciting to make a difference in the outcome of a very sick patient. Of course, we're always part of a team. There are physicians, respiratory therapists, physical therapists. There are so many people involved. But to be part of that team and to really see somebody get better. I then, after a number of years, really didn't pay very much attention to what goes on with a patient once they leave the hospital. But as a nurse, I was always aware this is a person who is not just a patient. If it were a man, he is a husband, a father, possibly a grandfather, has brothers, sisters, woman, same type of thing, mother, grandmother. People have lives, and they need to get back to those lives. A lot of times people would come back and see us, visit, and look just wonderful, and we would always love to see that. Somebody that you look at and say, wow, they're back, and it looks like they've resumed their life. And sometimes they can do that on their own, and other people need help. So it enables me to ask some questions and explore other opportunities. And I had the opportunity to work in cardiac rehab and get to see part of this process that some people, after they experience a heart attack, some cardiology event, are actually quite frightened and are not quite sure that they can pick up their lives and go forward. So I was able to see nurses, exercise specialists, physical therapists help them do that. And I thought that this would be really a good thing for me to do, an evolution, so to speak, because I think you always need to look for opportunities in nursing, and there are so many. And I got into cardiac rehab, and from that actually was a participant in developing a more complete wellness program here at Portsmouth Hospital, because the administration was very supportive to doing that and helping a lot of people not only reduce heart risk, but to engage in healthy behaviors such as increasing exercise or learning how to exercise, eat well and focus on managing their stress. And so we developed this into both a community wellness program as well as an employee wellness program.
Right, and in addition to that, what I'm just so delighted to hear about, and I'm sure the audience is too, is that you've brought in some wonderful support services and modalities, such as Reiki for anyone in the hospital. And you also have an acupuncturist who is on staff, and I believe massage is available as well. You were sharing with me about how the oncology department in particular is very open to the support modalities for the people who are going through, you know, their experience of cancer or chemo. Would you tell us about these modalities and how they've been integrated into your program there at the hospital and how they've been met both by the patients as well as the staff?
Well, they certainly have been met with great enthusiasm. The staff will actually alert the Reiki therapist, the massage therapist, of someone who might be in need of their services. The patients really enjoy both massage and Reiki for the purpose of relaxing them. Everybody does better if they're more relaxed. It's not unusual to come into a hospital and certainly have an anxiety level over the illness, over whatever the treatment's going to be, over the surgery, and both of these modalities certainly help relax people. In the chemotherapy clinic, very brief sessions are done of both Reiki and massage, and on a whether the patient wants this or, you know, it certainly is a patient choice, but it's always offered to patients, and I'm not sure that anybody turns this down. Reiki is something that probably is less familiar to people, but since we've been offering it since 1996 at Portsmouth Hospital, it's become a little bit more well-known here than it perhaps is in other areas, but mm-hmm. certainly is very well-received by patients.
Yes, and how... The question is always when we're discussing this, because as you know, several years ago, a number of years ago, which is how I got to know about the wonderful work that you're doing up there, my organization was interfacing with Portsmouth Hospital about some of these different, you know, concepts of serving inpatient and outpatient care. And the question is always, how does the medical staff embrace or respond to, and how inclusive does this become to their medical care?
Well, it will always vary. Many physicians were supportive to Reiki. The person who started the Reiki program here was actually a surgical nurse, and she had certainly a relationship with a lot of the surgeons, and because they knew her and certainly respected her practice, they, let's say, probably had kept an open mind to Reiki. And so actually the Reiki program started in the surgical service areas, and that was in 1996, and then expanded really in about a year to include all of the services offered in the hospital. So some of the doctors, you always need that, to have some support, and she had the support of physicians, the surgeons, and then went on to certainly get the support from other physicians. There are some physicians who really were reluctant to have their patients have Reiki treatments. Some of the physicians don't believe that it's very helpful, or they think it's the placebo effect, and they think, well, but that's okay too. So you do get a mixed, you know, sort of a mix of how the physicians actually think about any of the integrative services. I think physicians definitely don't want, they certainly don't like the term alternative, because that certainly suggests that you're not using the best of the Western medicine and just, you know, completely thinking that, you know, you want to use the Eastern type of healing. And so I think they're a little bit intimidated by that, but as long as it can complement each of the modalities can complement each other, I think they're certainly less intimidated by that.
One question for you. I know that this was quite popular, and rightfully so, to be incorporated into surgical med services in hospitals. Do you use the Peggy Huddleston's Prepare for Surgery, Heal Faster program that I know has has found its way very wonderfully into many of the hospitals in, at least I know, the New England area.
We actually did. Peg came up here and did give a talk, and we did start with that, with her method, and then actually did not continue with it. Through the New Hampshire Alliance for Integrative Healthcare Services, some of the people had some issues with some of all of what Peg was doing, and because of that, we, you know, we're using Reiki, and we actually do have another relaxation tape. So at the present moment, we are not using her method, but actually did introduce that and did use it for a brief period of time.
But the good news is that you are using modalities which invite the patient, especially I think that we're all very much aware of the anxiety and the terror of having a diagnosis and being medicated, dealing with the results of medication, the symptoms, the change in your feelings, your behavior, your attitude, your ability to function. And isn't that a really difficult experience? And so when people are in the hospital, when they're considering having a surgical intervention, isn't it wonderful that these are available? What kinds of feedback are you getting from the patients themselves, Elaine? Any particular comments that you know, that kind of stand out in your mind, things that you've all shared with each other about how the patients are responding?
Yes. Actually, we give the patients a survey to complete, and some of the questions are on a Likert scale so we can compare and see if there's an improvement, if that scale is moving up and down. And we ask them things such as, did it meet their needs? We also measure, using the pain scale, did it decrease pain? Did it decrease anxiety? And we do find that it will decrease pain very often, but the higher numbers are, it does decrease anxiety. So that's measurable on the Likert scale. And they will comment, people say, this is an absolutely wonderful service that you're offering. We really appreciate it. Thank you. So we do get some really good feedback from the Reiki.
Isn't that wonderful? So it's just, I think, heartwarming to those of us who are in, I know the New England area, I can speak for, because, and I know you can too, because we're located here, there seems to be a real acceptance as the last 5 years have evolved for this kind of energetic intervention. And we talk to nurses from all over the country, and I think that while it's definitely, you know, spreading across and being appreciated across the country, it's a little bit more remarkable that here in the East Coast, I guess, we have a reputation, you know, for being just a little bit picky, and it's wonderful to see that here on the East Coast that these services are being embraced and being integrated into hospitals up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So it's just wonderful to hear this, and congratulations on so much of the work that you've done, and I know your predecessors have done, to make this possible. Now, if you can believe this, Elaine, our first 12 minutes have gone ticking by. We're going to take a two-minute break. When we come back, we're going to, with the great generosity of your sharing this, we're going to talk about the time you spent in Da Nang and in Vietnam as a nurse. And I think that the story is so rich and meaningful. One of the things that we as a culture have not had a chance to do, we really haven't heard from our nurses who served. We've unfortunately heard a lot of very sad stories and very tragic stories and painful stories from our servicemen who served over in Vietnam. But I'm really just so pleased that you're willing to share with us the poignancy of your experience back in the late 60s and the incredible work that you did. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about your experiences in Da Nang. We'll
okay.
Be right back.
Which sound is more disturbing, the crying child or the total absence of footsteps from anyone coming to help? AIDS has created over 14 million orphans worldwide. That's the equivalent of every child under 5 in America, with nobody to watch over them. To help, please go to apathyislethal.org. AIDS is preventable. Apathy is lethal.
Brought to you by the United Nations Foundation and the Ad Council.
I'm coming to get you!
Kids, it's getting dark.
Okay. Hi, I'm Lois. I'm a real true life mother of 5, and I'd like to tell you about a cause that I've spent nearly the last 4 years ignoring. The futures of kids in my community. How do I do it? Oh, it's easy. I just don't show my support for after school programs. And here's the best part. It takes absolutely no effort. All you have to do is sit there, in your car, in your home, wherever it's most convenient to do nothing. After-school programs are available in less than a third of the schools in the U.S., and my indifference is helping to ensure that they'll get even less funding. Hey, we all know what that means. Less chances for kids to grow and learn. Right, kids?
Right, Mom.
So won't you please join me in ignoring children everywhere by not calling 1-866-KIDS today or not logging on to afterschoolnow.org.
After-school programs. Ignore them and they'll go away. A public service message brought to you by the After School Alliance, the Moss Foundation, and the Ad Council.
And we're back. You're listening to Celebrating Whole Health. This is a program that focuses on creating a renaissance of relationship-centered whole person health care. And every day we speak to a nurse who is dedicated to providing compassionate, patient-centered care. I'm your host, Georgiana Donatio, the director of the New England School of Whole Health Education in Boston. And today we have been talking and continue to talk with Elaine Hanglin. Elaine is a certified cardiac risk reduction nurse. And Elaine has spent a good deal of her life working in critical care prior to her recent career, which is cardiac care. And part of that was spent from 1968 to 1969 as a nurse serving in Da Nang. And Elaine, you are so kind to share with us this area of subject, because many of us, most of us, have many questions and have very little opportunity to hear the voice of the nurses from Vietnam. So if you would be kind enough, if you would invite us into the world that you were working and living in 1968 in Da Nang.
Sure. Well, I actually decided to go into the Air Force because I would listen to the 6 o'clock news. Obviously, you couldn't listen to the news without hearing what was going on in Vietnam. And I joined the Air Force, and you couldn't go directly to Vietnam. I was stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. And it took me a little bit of time before I actually decided I was going to do this, because I was young, life was good. Being in the military was a very interesting experience. I was getting some good clinical experience. And met many, many nice people from all over the country, but I had to keep reminding myself that I really joined the Air Force to go to Vietnam. So I did volunteer. We were all volunteers. The nurses were volunteers. And finally, I did get orders, and I did get to go to Da Nang. I guess probably when you make a decision and time gets to be drawing near, we were all volunteers. The nurses were volunteers. And finally, I did get orders, and I did get to go to Da Nang. I guess probably when you make a decision and time gets to be drawing near, I did certainly get a little bit nervous about my decision. Took a long time to fly over to Vietnam, and I didn't know what to expect when I would get off the plane. However, I was very fortunate, and every nurse was not this fortunate, but we had a colonel who was our chief nursing officer, who met the plane herself or sent somebody to meet the plane. So I didn't arrive in a very strange environment and find that I was all alone. So that was certainly a big help. And what I was able to and what I'm able to say is the whole year, I was there for 1 year, and that was the typical tour of duty. I continued to get the support from older nurses and from many of the people who also supported the troops in Vietnam.
Now, you told me that this was a life-altering experience. Here you were, You were a very young woman, innocent in the world, innocent in many ways, because we lived in a fairly innocent society back then. And here you were stabilizing very severely wounded and often mortally wounded soldiers who were brought into your staging hospital and were prepared to be flown either out to Japan or to more surgical care. And this was an intensely emotional as well as intensely physical kind of work that you were doing. Would you tell us about those young men and tell us about the kinds of interactions that you had with many of them?
Yes, certainly. I started to say that when I landed in Vietnam, the experience sort of began there, looking around and looking at what my living situation would be for a year and thinking to myself, oh my goodness, a year is an awful long time. And that lasted not very long. The evening, the first night that I spent in the quarters, I woke up to the battleship New Jersey firing over my head. And, of course, that was certainly very intimidating. And I thought, my goodness, a year is going to be an awfully long time. What have I done? However, when I got to the hospital the very next day, where the casualty staging flight, as we called it, I realized that this was not about me. What I saw were young men. The average age of the fighting men, soldiers and Marines in Vietnam, was 19. I was in my early 20s, so they were younger than me. So I saw young men who actually were paying the price for freedom, a much higher price than I was paying. And I just immediately responded to them. They were the most wonderful people, most wonderful patients that I've ever taken care of. They were very selfless at the time that we were taking care of them. They were happy because many of them were going home, so that was a good thing for them that their tour was over, they were going home. They had very bad wounds. More people, because of the helicopters picking people, patients up, they were able to be saved, so they really had some pretty severe wounds. Those that could actually talk were, you know, happy and smiling, as I said, because they would be going home. They would help each other out. If there were any possibility that they could help one of their buddies out, they would do that. They wouldn't expect anyone else to. It was actually some of the more mature nurses who helped me realize that they would have a very difficult time adjusting to these injuries when they returned home. Again, because of my youth, this wasn't something that I would necessarily be able to tease out of the situation. The wounds were anywhere from a craniotomy. At that time, seeing people who had head injuries, they looked, they started to waste, and they just looked terrible. These men, when their families saw them, there would be no question that their wounds were so terrible. Sometimes now, because of the way we can feed people, people would be in a coma and have a head injury, and you look at them and they kind of look like they're sleeping. They look like themselves. That wasn't the case then. We just didn't have that. That was one of the things that we didn't have. We had so many ways, and this is in the not just in the military, but certainly this was not something that we were capable of doing, was adequately feeding people and preventing wasting at that time. I will say that the equipment, anything that we had in the military was the very best. What we had certainly was comparable to anything that we can find that you would find in any medical center in the country. As I said, the patients themselves were those who would have injuries that they thought they would more easily overcome, certainly were happy about going home. Others were not. The craniotomies I mentioned, spinal cord injuries, severe burns, triple amputations, people with, you know, men with triple, three limbs gone, those were certainly, people were realizing that their recovery was not going to be that quick. Head injuries, you certainly would not know what anybody would be thinking. So seeing a lot of young men passing through the casualty staging, we would stabilize them so that they would take about a six-hour plane ride to Japan on a C-141, which was actually designed as a cargo plane, and this plane was then made to carry patients. They needed to be stable for that flight because they were traveling over the ocean and they wouldn't be able to land. So that was our job, was to do that for the patients so that they would be able to get to Japan. They would get to Japan or they would get to the Philippines, and then from there they would eventually go home. Some of them would actually go to Japan or the Philippines, have surgery, and be sent back into the field. So the seeing so many men, and I guess seeing that it just didn't stop, day after day, we would send a large volume out. The next day we would get a large volume in. So just seeing the numbers just kind of running by in your mind, that that this just didn't happen to a few people, this was happening every day to a lot of people, was certainly a difficult thing to adjust to.
We talked about several points that I think are really important that when we come back from our next break, we'd love to have you address. You talked about the carnage of an entire generation of men.
Yes.
You talked about witnessing the physical and emotional wounding of an entire group of an age that we, even to this day, are still recovering from in terms of seeing the carnage in our 50-year-old men who have been through Vietnam and have suffered so much pain because when you came home, and we're going to talk about that, what you experienced upon your return, what you experienced, what they experienced, and I think it speaks to the nursing profession of how caring or not caring can be very curative or it can be very harmful. And we discussed that in depth, and I know that when we come back you're going to discuss it again, but I want to mention one other point. You talked about, you said, you know, before I went over there, I had a very glamorized, as we all did in the United States, we had a very glamorized version of what war was about. And for those of us who spent the 12 years watching MASH and then watching the reruns, there is a kind of a concept in a lot of our minds that this in some way, was a romantic or a highly patriotic thing that was going on over there, and yet there was a lot of emotional ups and downs for the nurses as well as for the soldiers who were serving there. So when we come back, it would be very meaningful for you to continue in this story about the glamorization of war, the carnage of the generation, and the unfortunate entrapment, if you will, of both those who were support services as well as the soldiers, the entrapment of being caught in between politics and societal perceptions. So we're going to take a two-minute break, Elaine, and we'll be back. And thank you again so much for being with us today. We so appreciate having you here. 2 minutes, we'll be right back.
Okay, so what do you get when you cross a ballerina with an insomniac? Someone who'll dance the night away. And that's what they're doing at a dance-a-thon put together by dancers in their community coalition to raise money for kids' after-school programs. All right, so what do you get when you cross a barber and a chef? A meal with all the trimmings. And that's what they're serving at a local youth center. Local merchants came together with their community coalition to make people's lives a little better. Now, what do you get when people bring their groups together? Healthier, happier, drug-free communities, especially for kids. So with your civic group, club, PTA, even your employer, contact your community coalition at helpyourcommunity.org or 877-KIDS-313. Because you get more when you get together. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
This is Sam Hornish Jr. As a champion IndyCar driver, I've had many proud moments, but one of the things I'm proudest of is being part of the Shriners. Shriners Hospitals offer kids with orthopedic problems or severe burns world-class medical care that's totally free of charge. And their centers of excellence combine progressive research and innovative teaching programs. There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area. For more information, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
And we're back with Elaine Hanglin. Elaine, before the break, several different points were brought up. One was the carnage of a whole generation of young men, the glamorization of war for many of us, not understanding what it was all about, and the notion or the essence of how caring, whether it's physical caring, emotional caring, political caring, can be such a powerful force in healing. Can you speak to that with your experience in the Vietnam War?
Certainly.
Call us at 866-687-7332. We are proud to have this program on the air for you. Thank you very much.
And we're back with Elaine Hanglin. You are listening to Celebrating Whole Health here at nursedaily.com. Elaine, before the break, several different points were brought up. One was the carnage of a whole generation of young men, the glamorization of war for many of us, not understanding what it was all about, and the notion or the essence of how caring, whether it's physical caring, emotional caring, political caring, can be such a powerful force in healing. Can you speak to that with your experience in the Vietnam War?
Certainly. Yes, I think that probably the horror of the war is certainly the carnage of a whole generation of mostly men and who sacrificed. Most of the men who went to Vietnam were not volunteers. Nurses were volunteers. They were drafted. And many men, I think, were frightened to go to Vietnam because the chances of dying were very high. The chances of coming back without limbs was very high. And you would know that because certainly the press reported the war as it was happening. And that was the first time that occurred, so that the public had certainly a lot of information about the war. What happened to a lot of the soldiers when they came home was that the public blamed them for the war. The public didn't seem to be able to separate that most of them, the men who went to war, really didn't want to go to war, but in their minds, this is their country, and they needed to do what their country expected of them. And when they came home, if they wore their uniforms, people, called them names and really took out their hostility about the war on the people who were serving. This didn't happen with the last two wars, and I certainly think that that is wonderful that the public was able to realize that the soldiers and Marines were doing what our country expected them to do. So that was a difficult thing, that the public's perception of the war and what they thought of soldiers and Marines. And I know some of it is, again, because of all of the media attention to this. There were some men who came home and spoke at universities, and where a lot of the anti-war sentiment was certainly centered, and they would be talking about some of the horrible things that they did, some of the things that they hurt women and children, whether it be accident or not an accident. And this, of course, was something that the press certainly like to get out to people, so people saw how terrible this was. So I think a lot of the soldiers and Marines were thought of as baby killers, and everyone wasn't, and that's one of the things that they were accused of. Certainly we know My Lai happened. There were things, and will happen in any war, there were things that nobody is proud of that happened. Certainly there are some attempts at trying to find out why did something like this happen.
But Elaine, you spoke so poignantly of the young men who would come in so terribly injured. They were out in the skirmishes. They were blown up. They were shot. They were burned. And you told one story that was so moving about a young man named Michael who was badly burned all over his entire body, a young 19-year-old soldier who came to the staging area. Would you share that story? Because I think it really points up to us what these young, the majority, the overwhelming majority, I'm sure there were a handful of soldiers who did not go through this and may have been on the other side of causing pain, but would you share with us the story of Michael?
One evening, about 12 or 15 men were brought in who were very badly burned, and they were going to be going out on a special flight. And when people are burned, one of the stabilization maneuvers, one of the things that we do, one of the treatments, is that we need to hydrate them. And there were certainly things that we needed to do for them. This particular soldier was bandaged like you would just picture a mummy, bandaged all over, and he had a tracheostomy, so he couldn't speak. And he was one of the patients that I was caring for, and I remember his first name, and this is one of the, this is a memory I will have forever. He just stands out in my mind, and I just wish that I could tell his family that he was just a wonderful person. He couldn't speak. He wanted me and I would to come to his, by his side, and he would signal me, and I would try to figure out what he needed. And again, from a clinical perspective, I could look at everything that I needed to look at and think, well, he's fine. He's doing perfectly fine. But there might have been something that he wanted to say and wasn't able to say, wanted to communicate. And I decided after time that maybe it was just that he needed the reassurance, that I needed to just keep coming by no matter what I needed to do. I needed to come by and to talk to him. And a difficult thing for me was usually when you talk to somebody, and where nursing is a hands-on profession, you could put your hand on somebody's shoulder and that could be comforting. And that was something I couldn't do without hurting him. So it made it a little bit more difficult. So I thought, well, it's going to have to be the sound of my voice talking to him. I also couldn't tell him everything was going to be all right because I don't know whether everything, and at that time didn't know, and I was thinking everything probably was not going to be all right. He had a very high chance of really suffering for quite some time and then and dying from the wound. When I went for the first time to the Vietnam Memorial to see that, which is just a beautiful memorial, and it is just as people describe, it has a healing effect. I looked at, at the wall, every names are on there, and I looked for Michael's and wondered who could he have been. I feel sort of a guilt that I can't remember a lot of names, but I would only take care of a patient for a short period of time, and I couldn't remember names, but I remember him. Many times I was able to write letters home, because many of the patients would have their hands bandaged and really couldn't use their hands. So I would write letters home and do things like that, but I didn't know his name. It was a very busy evening, and I guess I have the guilt that I could have done more, and I didn't, and I wish that I could tell his family that people were with him, like me, other nurses and corpsmen were with him, and that somebody was with him during that time that he really needed so much care and so much emotional support.
Elaine, isn't it so that whether we're dealing with a patient such as Michael, or we're dealing with a cardiac patient or an oncology patient or a pediatric or geriatric patient, that what the only thing we can truly give to one another, besides the best medical care that is available, is our presence, is our respectful witnessing to their life, their story, and their pain. And you shared so movingly with me the way that you and so many of the other nurses felt. You felt guilty, that you couldn't do enough, you couldn't be there enough, you couldn't sit and talk long enough or hold their hand enough. And it was a very difficult time for you. Sometimes you slept longer because you, it was kind of a way of avoiding some of the trauma of wanting to give so much, wanting to comfort so much and not being able to. You said some of the older nurses kind of, they were in denial. They took the tough route and, you know, just kind of blocked a lot of it out. But for you, wasn't that witnessing to those soldiers and just bringing your presence there, wasn't that the most meaningful thing as you had shared that with me?
Yes. As I look back, yes, it was. Again, it's difficult to be in the situation, and I believe that what I did was also deny at times, because I think that was the only way to come back the next day and care for people. And also it was a time of confusion, trying to decide what can you do and how much can you do. So there was some confusion. It was certainly it was an emotional state. And yes, I think some of the nurses asked at one time, well, what do you do while you're here because of what you're seeing? You know, are you a different person? And again, I think because I was young, I said, no, I don't think I do anything different. Well, I'm sure I did, but that was maybe painful for me to explore. Also, if you think of the times, it wasn't for me to be thinking about myself. I needed to be thinking of patients. We didn't have the stress debriefing and things that we do know that medical people need to have now in order to continue to do their job. So I think there was, you know, certainly was some denial on my part that no, I, you know, my needs are not important and you know, I don't need to go there. I'm not saying that, I should have. I'm saying that's the way things were at that time, and that's the way I probably, you know, thought that was best to deal with things.
And isn't that has been a tone of, I think, many of the women, many of the nurses that returned from Vietnam. We talked about it, and you said initially we didn't talk about it. We really avoided it. We never heard the voice of the nurses from Vietnam for many, many years until the Women's Memorial went up. And you commented, you said, we talked about it when we did talk about it, finally, that it was the best of times and it was the worst of times, and that it was such an intense and yet so difficult and rewarding. It was a real potpourri of experience and of emotion. When we come back, we're going to take another break. There are several things that we want to talk about. We'd like to talk about how this affected you politically, how it affected you spiritually. You're also the mother of two sons, and your sons, you've been in the Air Force, your husband's been in the Air Force, you had two sons that were looking at the Gulf War period of time when that started. So when we come back, let's talk about the impact on you as a mom, as a woman, as a political human being. So we're going to take a very short break, Elaine. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
I don't want my daughter to be labeled.
Hey, my son was just like I was in school. What's the big deal?
My daughter's just going through a phase. She'll get over it.
Kids with learning difficulties don't need excuses. They need help. Today, there are millions of kids with learning difficulties, and they're struggling in school. But the fact is, a lot of these kids are smart. They just learn differently. So if you're the parent of a child who's struggling to learn, the more you learn, the better off your child will be. If you act now and get the proper help, your child can do well in school and in life. So if you think that there's something wrong, do something right. Now, get help. For free information on how to help your child, visit www.focusonlearning.org, www.focusonlearning.org, or call 1-888-478-MIND. Do it for your child. Do it for yourself. But do it now. A message from the Advertising Council and the Coordinated Campaign for Learning Disabilities.
Oh, great shot. Hi, I'm Robert.
And I'm Mabel.
Now that we're retired, we have more time for doing the things we've always wanted, like shrugging off the future of our nation's youth.
It's so easy. All you have to do is not support after-school programs. 15 million youngsters in this country are left unsupervised after school, and our genuine lack of concern can help make sure they find trouble, not opportunities.
Doing nothing has never been this easy.
Rummage sales, winery tours, yes. Tai Chi classes, oh, there's all sorts of great ways to ignore the needs of children. If you want to show how little you care about after-school programs, don't call 1-866-KIDS today.
And don't log on to afterschoolnow.org. Mabel, it's a wonderful feeling to make such a negative impact.
I love you, Robert.
After-school programs. Ignore them and they'll go away. A public service message brought to you by the After School Alliance, the Mott Foundation, and the Ad Council.
We're back at Celebrating Whole Health with Elaine Hanglin, who is sharing with us her very poignant, moving, and meaningful experience as a nurse in Da Nang in 1968 to 1969. Elaine, before the break, we were talking about several things. One of them was the impact that this experience had on you as a mom. You have two sons of your own. And as a political and spiritual human being, I know one of the questions that I have, and I'm sure the audience has, is did you ever have the opportunity to follow up with any of the soldiers who you were able to serve at that time?
No, I was not able to look for people and to find them. And that was certainly a difficult thing. And I think I talked about that when I had gone to the
soldiers who you were able to serve at that time.
No, I was not able to look for people and to find them. And that was certainly a difficult thing. And I think I talked about that when I had gone to the memorial and tried to find Michael's name, and I didn't even realize what his last name was. I will share with you, though, that the CEO of our company, Portsmouth Regional Hospital, actually was a Marine in Vietnam, and he had come through the casualty staging flight at Da Nang. So I was able to, we've talked together, and we've gone out and actually to the University of New Hampshire and done some talks along with other soldiers and Marines to the students and answered their questions. So occasionally, I've had the opportunity to run into somebody, but not that I was able to myself look up and find.
I'm sure that was difficult. I'm sure there were many things you wanted to say to their families and you wanted to say to them. And here you are. You're a mom of two boys who, back in the early 90s, when we were looking at the Gulf War situation, you being a veteran, your husband being a veteran, what was that like for you? What was your experience of your concerns for your own sons at that time?
Well, I was certainly frightened by the war. Both of my sons, my older son had just entered high school at that point, so he was in high school, so it would have been him that I was more immediately thinking of than my younger son, and certainly that intimidated me, the thoughts that my son could be drafted. There were always rumors that, well, you know, we could reinstitute the draft and that he might be going to war. So I watched the news and talked to him, the war lasted just, you know, a very short period of time, and that wasn't going to be the case. It became apparent pretty early on that wasn't going to be the case, but certainly that is intimidating to a mother.
I'm
because
sure.
There's no question that while I was in Vietnam, I knew that all of the soldiers and Marines had mothers, fathers, sisters, siblings, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, wives, fiancés, many friends who had great concern for their well-being.
And I'm sure that if you could have, you would have reached out and let them know, as you said, that someone was there. And I go back to this because I think it's the essence of nursing. I think it's the essence of human need and caring to for us to be present with people. Sometimes the only thing we can do, sometimes the only thing we can do is to stand present to another person's life, their story, their experience, their process. And I'm sure that every day you were in Vietnam that you were called to do that and so much more. And we talked about the aftermath for you when you came back and you asked the questions, what was the purpose of this? Why did a generation of young men, why were they maimed and lost? You made a funny comment. You said that the Vietnamese called the war the American War, and as opposed to the French War, which was their experience as well. And you asked the question, what was the purpose of this? And it raised for you, you had said that you were angry at the public for not understanding. You were angry at the government for not really being very upfront or clear about so much of the war. Do you want to comment about how that has changed the way you look at things and how it brought you to serve so deeply into the relationship-centered care that you currently provide for your patients?
Well, yes. Certainly, I was disillusioned with our government. Prior to going to Vietnam, we touched on that war was glamorized and that people wanted to go to war to support our government. The mission wasn't very clear when we were in Vietnam, so there were a lot of questions. The public, again, I think I certainly spoke to that the they failed to separate the soldiers, Marines, from the political decision to go to war. I certainly was confused about the Vietnamese people because certainly the ones that we knew seemed to be just like us, that they wanted certainly spoke to that the they failed to separate the soldiers, Marines, from the political decision to go to war. I certainly was confused about the Vietnamese people because certainly the ones that we knew seemed to be just like us, that they wanted to be happy, that the mothers wanted the best for their children, and yet they were they supported us, and then they also supported the Viet Cong and supported the North Vietnamese Army, that was somewhat confusing, but it took me a while to sort that out and realize, well, they were certainly in a bad position, and they did what they had to do. I just recently learned that they referred to the war as the American War, and that's what I guess I came to the realization is that the Vietnamese people and the American people were not necessarily wanting to harm each other. They definitely were not wanting to harm each other, but this was a political decision. This was a decision made because of politics between governments, more than two governments, to get into the situation. I think that it certainly built on the fact that people are people and they have many needs, not just their physical needs. So it has helped me throughout my certainly nursing career. And I will always remember how wonderful the soldiers and Marines were. They were grateful, respectful to us. I also feel that the doctors, nurses, other support personnel made the best of a really bad situation. And I feel that I was part of history and that I really believe that I know more about that narrow part of history than others do. And what I learned was about really enforcing the inherent goodness in people. So in a way, I have since then always had faith that people will do the right thing. I've seen them in a bad situation really do the right thing. I vote. I certainly have never turned on the government, and I want to say that having been to Vietnam and having been in the Orient, when I saw some of the things I did, we still have an absolutely wonderful country and a wonderful government, even though at times government may make mistakes, that we have the best life of anybody in the world. I think that we do need to, from time to time, do things that we need to do, certainly to support the government, and not only support the government when it's convenient to do that. So I guess that's probably the, I've come, you know, from being disillusioned and angry to being more supportive, and as I said earlier, supporting the troops that are now fighting our wars, I think we've come a long way, and I guess, like all of us, we make mistakes, and if we can learn from them, I think that certainly is all you can expect.
Well, I think the hopeful message in your story is that it really does sound as if we have learned, at least with regard to how we do our military. We now have a voluntary army, which is kind of wonderful, because we do not have young men and women being drafted anymore into the service. So I think that that's a big thing.
Yes.
And you've touched on some very important things about the goodness of people, the goodness of what I like to say, of us ordinary people, those of us who are not in positions of power making these global decisions about things like war, for those of us who, you know, are blessed to be ordinary people living ordinary lives, which what a wonderful position to be in, not to be in the hot seat, so to speak, that we are good and that most people are inherently and innately good. I'd like to ask you about your experience of the Women's Memorial that was dedicated in 1993. You had said that on the Vietnam Memorial, while there were only about 11 or so women, but when you went down to the Women's Memorial, that had a tremendous impact on you. Would you share that with us?
Yes. The dedication of the Women's Memorial was in November of 1993, and that was my first opportunity to actually meet with a lot of the nurses I served with. So that was certainly a wonderful experience, and we were able to talk and share experiences that, you know, went beyond the war. A lot of other veterans were able to connect and meet on a more regular basis, but that's not really the case with Vietnam veterans. I was able to meet a lot of men who served in Vietnam, some of whom said just what you had touched on earlier, it didn't ruin my life. They had served, they were fortunate enough to leave Vietnam without a major injury, and they continued and continued to be productive members of society. And I loved hearing that type of thing. We did meet with some of the physicians who were there, and that was just a great experience for me, as well as I think a lot of the nurses. We were we marched in a parade, and so many of the men were there supporting, and they also helped with the memorial. Both memorials, the Vietnam Memorial, the women's, were funded privately. And actually the government was petitioned to put them on the mall, and that was done. And just meeting some of the soldiers, Marines, who were just so grateful, even if I didn't remember who they were, they didn't remember who I was either, but just were so positive and continued to be grateful for what we had done for them.
You had said an interesting thing in our interview. You said, I didn't talk about it when I came back. I didn't think anybody cared. I didn't cry about it. I didn't really allow myself to dwell on it at all. But when you went to the memorial, it was as if there was a permission and an invitation to share this kind of collective release, this collective grief and this collective release regarding when the memorial went up, and how it was a very healing thing.
Yes, particularly the Vietnam Memorial. That was my first opportunity when I went to the dedication of the Women's Memorial to see the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and I just stood there, and that was the first time I started to cry, and people would walk by, pat me on the shoulder, and I was so comfortable that I could just stand there and I could just cry in public, and that I would just had the opportunity to let that come out. And I had heard so much about the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and sometimes I thought, well, I might not see it the same way. I might be disappointed, but that wasn't the case. So the wall is very healing. And to actually just look, scan, and see all the names, you can go up to the wall and you can actually take a chalk and you can make a, you can take a copy of someone's name home with you. And I'm sure that's comforting for families. And you also will see all of the things that people will leave. The veterans keep coming by, families come by. There'll be pictures of a young Marine in his dress uniform, and they'll leave personal things and notes, personal notes for people. And it's a wonderful thing to see that the soldiers and Marines honor, and everybody who went to Vietnam, we honor our dead. And that this is an opportunity to do that. It's very tangible. You can do that privately when you're praying, but to be able to do it publicly, I think, just is healing, just what you just as you described.
Isn't it always, whether we're in the hospital or whether we're in the office or whether we're in a community, isn't it always a collective consciousness that we share the goodness, the humanity, the compassion, the love that human beings are capable of, that when we come to that sacred place of relationship with one another, that we are able to transcend and to heal so many wounds, be they physical wounds or emotional wounds. And the story that you shared with us, and I had the privilege of listening to you tell it to me at another time, definitely reminds us that our presence to one another, with one another, both individually and as a community, as a collective community, is not only important, but it's critical and necessary to our humanity, for us to be whole, for us to be well, that when we're in a hospital or in a community that embraces us and values us, that is the greatest gift that we can give to one another. We're going to take our last break, and when we come back, Elaine, we're only going to have a minute or two, but before we let you go, we would love to have your final thoughts on how your experience as a young nurse during the Vietnam conflict and your experience as a more mature, experienced nurse has come together, and what you would share with us in your thoughts about whole person, holistic, whole health care and presence. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Hey, you seen Ronnie lately?
No, so?
Well, I hear he's totally buff now.
Ronnie buff?
Totally history buff.
Whoa, here he comes now.
Hey, lovelies. You know, I was just thinking about the founding fathers.
Wow.
Tough call in the 1780s about who gets authority. Shaking new federal government or the established power of the 13 states. Kind of makes you think. Well, gotta go.
Smooth. He is so buff.
So history buff.
Wow, but how?
He's been working out at LOC.gov, Library of Congress website, Whole American Experience in film, photos, music, and fun-filled facts.
Whoa, check out Clarence.
Hey, love to talk, but I gotta go exercise my mind at LOC.gov.
Want to get really history buff? Visit LOC.gov, the Library of Congress website, and find out more about history, America's great national pastime. A public service message brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Would you leave us with some thoughts about how your very extraordinary journey has kind of coalesced and come together for you at this point in your life?
Yes. I think that I would just like to say, as a young nurse, we learn about, I certainly learned, and I'm sure most nurses, that people have physical, emotional, spiritual needs. And as a young nurse, sometimes we sort of compartmentalize these and look for something that is more, that is very tangible. As I developed, certainly, as a nurse, and my critical care experience certainly taught me this, my Vietnam experience, my continued critical care experience, taught me to almost get a gestalt, if you would, like a picture of someone. And I think that's something that comes with maturing and experience, to be able to do that and to truly realize that people are not just one compartment or the other, or one need doesn't necessarily stand out, you know, from the others, that people are whole, and that's the way they're going to heal, is if we deal with them as a whole person. And what you pointed out, I think, so well, I don't think I can state any better, is sometimes just the presence with someone is very valuable. While I didn't realize that when I was in Da Nang, I have come to realize so much more since I've been a more experienced nurse.
Elaine, we are so grateful to you for being on the show today, for sharing your extraordinary story, journey, and the heart of the work that you do. We thank you, we bless you, and wish you all the best up at the hospital, and would love to hear back from you to do a follow-up and see how that wonderful program at the Portsmouth Hospital is going. Thanks again, and we're going to be tuning in tomorrow with another extraordinary nurse who is serving compassionate care. So please join us tomorrow, and have a wonderful day.